Sustainable Hour.
For green, clean, sustainable Geelong. The Sustainable Hour.
Good morning, listeners. We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders, past, present, and those to come. And then finally, pay tribute to the great work that One Fire is doing in Geelong for reconciliation.
This is an emergency, and world leaders are not acting accordingly. But if they won't do anything, then we will.
I believe those who are causing our planet to heat up, destroying our ecosystems and biosphere that we depend on for life, are violating my rights as a child. And now I want you to hold them accountable. I believe the children of the world have the right to a stable climate system that will support our development and life, as well as the life of future generations.
Either the members of the government know that the climate is changing and it is slowly destroying the country as we know it, and they choose to do nothing, and that is unconscionable and unfathomable, or they are willfully ignorant, which, Deputy Speaker, I suggest is just as bad. This will be, well, this already is, and this will continue to be the most shocking act of intergenerational social injustice this country has ever seen. Don't we care about our children, Deputy Speaker? I do, and at the end of my days, I want to be known by my children as someone who tried to do something along with my colleagues on the crossbench. How members of the government will face their children and can think about their children and their children, it just beggars belief. It is shocking intergenerational social injustice.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
We are the land of droughts. Flooding rains. We recognise that it is a very volatile and often capricious climate.
At the heart of this conflict is a battle between truth and science and power and lies.
Change is coming, we are few but we are strong. Time's been wasted and we haven't got too long. Mother's dying, we can feel it in our bones. So we're rebelling on a system that is wrong. Change is coming, we are few but we are strong. Time's been wasted and we haven't got too long. Mother's dying, we can feel it in our bones. So we're
Change is coming. Change is coming big time. And next week we are going to announce different things that are happening, aren't we, Tony? It's in a way exciting, you know. While Geelong Council last week rejected to declare a climate emergency here for our city, everywhere else I'm looking around the world, people are joining this movement. I'm beginning to call it a revolution in a way. It's a climate emergency revolution because it's people getting together in all sorts of groups. Now it's also the professional groups that are coming together. It's doctors, it's social workers, it's engineers and so on. And you know this saying, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. I thought about that last week because what we saw there, because it was rejection from the council, these 200 people who were rejected and felt stepped on in a way, they had come to council meeting and tried to push for that we declare a climate emergency here for our city so that we could change the story how we talk about climate change. Yet that wasn't to be. But the group that was there has since then, I feel, you know, become even stronger. And this was a really broad group of the community. It wasn't just the green activists, the climate activists and so on. This was the real everybody, high and low in community. It was the doctors and it was the lawyers and one end, but it was people from the street just as well. It was kids.
Unprecedented in the time I've had here.
Exactly. So the news that I'm picking up now is that there's a new You know the Extinction Rebellion that we'll talk more about because of what's going to happen next week? They have three demands. They say, number one, declare a climate emergency. Number two, act accordingly. And number three, create citizens' assemblies so that we take, you know, the power out of the politicians who are in one way or the other corrupted and not understanding what needs to be done. But citizens do, so let's create citizens' assembly and give them the power to decide how we move on from here. That's the Extinction Rebellion's three demands. So here in Geelong, the groups that gathered there, they decided, why should we wait for governments to create a citizen assembly for us? Why don't we just do it? So now Geelong actually has the Geelong Citizens Assembly. It's being established. And if you want to be part of that, the Fridays for Future movement is happening every Friday where people are gathering in front of City Hall. They will continue to do that in support of Greta Thunberg's mission where she's school striking and all that. But these are also adults now coming together. And this Friday, I think, will be the foundation of the Citizens Assembly of Geelong. Happening there in front of City Council. That is an interesting movement. I just wanted to play one clip. There's so many videos and so on circulating in social media and so on, but there was one that stood out this week. David Hood, he's an engineer. He gave a little presentation, just a selfie, where he's filming himself talking about why he thinks that engineers should come together now and support the petition that's running where engineers are putting their name. If they're an organization or if as an individual, they're putting their name under that they are calling for the umbrella body for all the engineers to declare a climate emergency.
Hi, I'm David Hood. I'm a chartered professional civil and environmental engineer. Why am I signing on to a declaration of a climate emergency by engineers? If it seems that I'm frowning and looking a bit worried, there's a damn good reason. I have been busy on the climate action journey for over 30 years using all the traditional methods of trying to get serious action on addressing global heating and consequent climate change. I've used all the traditional methods, urging Engineers Australia, blogging, joining action groups, having conversations, doing big presentations, conference keynotes, letter writing, visiting and pleading with politicians and so on. But as Tim Flannery so bluntly put it earlier this week, we have failed. We have failed spectacularly. Sure, we've seen technology advances in energy efficiency, innovation, and many other areas, and small steps in greening the built environment and in some business activities. Alone, these changes are simply insufficient when new governments continue to approve massive coal mines, gas extraction, and new oil exploration in sacred and beautiful natural environments. And the base cause of the climate crisis, the rise in greenhouse gas emissions, just continues unabated. It's as if politicians and business chiefs do not get the connection, or they are being paid to ignore it. Pussyfooting around the issue is just no longer an option. Vice President Al Gore, founder of the Climate Reality Project, in 2012 called for civil disobedience as the only way to bring about the real changes we need. We've waited for long enough. Change must happen, and we must bring it on. We now have the spectacular rise of Extinction Rebellion over the past 12 months. So what can engineers do? I regard the professions as having a particularly serious responsibility to tell the truth to society and to act accordingly. Our code of ethics requires it. We face an existential threat. The risk of delaying action any further is unacceptable to our profession of engineering. It's time that engineers accepted the responsibility and called climate change what it is. A real climate emergency, and that's why I'm signing.
Said David Hood, and if you are an engineer, you could go to this website that he's talking about. It has a very long, it's a Google page, so it has an incredibly long link that is impossible to read in the radio for you. But what we do is we put that link up on the Sustainable Hours Facebook page and also on climatesafety.info. So look there if you are an engineer and you want to, you know, contribute with your name to this petition. And there's so many other things happening. You can actually go to another website, which is called climateemergencydeclaration.org. That is a long URL, but it's worth remembering. ClimateEmergencyDeclaration.org. There is where you find all the news, including this one about the engineers. while we talk about big solutions, and big problems do require big solutions, such as a declaration at national level. And by the way, no, I can't not mention this. Did you see that there's a petition happening where in the last week, more than 170,000 Australians have now signed a petition asking the federal government and the parliament, the Australian parliament, to declare a climate emergency. And this is an e-petition. That means it's an official petition that the politicians cannot ignore. So that is exciting that this happened within a week, just in one day, which was yesterday, 70,000 people more signed onto it. I'm thinking, can we reach a million? I don't
know.
That'd be great. You know, I just wanted to mention that because if you haven't signed that petition, go there. Please find it. Again, look for the Sustainable Hours Facebook page, and we have a link there already that's pointing out to this exciting petition. 3 years ago, it took us a year to collect 20,000 signatures. Now we get 70,000 signatures for the same ask in one day. This is something that has really, you know, excited me in the last time. Now, what I wanted to say was that, you know, house owners are doing their bit. And we have something exciting coming up in Geelong on the 13th of October. It's an annual event. It's happened over the last 10 years. And it is the Sustainable House Day. In this case, this year, 15 different houses are going to open their doors. And we have lots of guests coming in the studio today. It's sort of like a Sustainable House Day special for you. And first of all, welcome to the President of Geelong Sustainability, Vicky Parrott. Like last year and like the year before and so on, you're the one to introduce us to the Sustainable House Day. And what's the news of this year?
This year is, again, I can say it's our biggest and most diverse program. So each year it gets bigger. This is our 11th year coordinating this event in the city on behalf of the council. But this year we're actually including houses in the Golden Plains Shire, in Surf Coast Shire, and even in the Queenscliff Borough. So 15 houses right across our region. So it really is casting a wide net. And we've got a really diverse range of houses. So we're trying to show people the sorts of things that they can do to make their homes more comfortable and cheaper to run and more enjoyable to live in and obviously better for the planet. So we've all got to take action. And starting it with our own homes where we will benefit and have a more enjoyable house is a great way to do it. So we've got new homes, some spectacular high star rating new homes, 7 and 8 star homes opening. But we've also got a range of houses where they're renovations or retrofits and in some cases they're work in progress quite deliberately so people can come along and get a bit of understanding of what to fix and when. We've got one house which we're setting up as a real demonstration how-to, and we'll have energy raters there using the government's accredited scorecard to help people see, well, what's the low fruit? If I'm going to try and improve my drafty cold house, what do I do first? Where will I get the biggest bang for my buck? So we're going to have some energy raters from the new social enterprise that Geelong Sustainability has set up, Greenlight, and we'll also have our wonderful friends from EcoMaster, which provide DIY advice and retrofitting products to people, as well as a local business, Go Green Glazing, which are the only specialist business in Geelong that can do secondary double glazing for people. So virtually at every house, there's going to be subject matter experts. So some of them, there'll be a builder. Some of them, there'll be a building designer or an architect. Others, we've got solar installers. And in others, we've got sort of garden experts in permaculture. I'm also excited that we've got a couple of properties opening in Norlane. And so we've got a very small house. So it's only 57 square metres, but it's a beautiful home. Lovely to live in. Lovely. Well, and Sue's coming in soon, so she'll tell you more about that. But also in Norlane, we have the wonderful young enterprising guys from the Urban Farm opening, and they'll be talking to people about, if you're renting a house, what are the low cost things that you can do to make your house more energy efficient, as well as what they've done on their large suburban block where they've turned it in to an urban farm that's growing community and doing wonderful things out in Norlane. So a very diverse range of houses. We encourage people to go to our website where we've got lots of photos and information about each house's sustainability features, as well as who will be the subject matter experts that will be on site, because 15 houses, you're going to struggle to get around them all, so you'll need to plan which ones. And we deliberately stagger the opening, so houses 1 to 7, which are in the Golden Plains and Geelong, will open from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m, and those on the Ballerine and down the Surf Coast will open from 1 to 5 p.m. So if you, for example, if you've got a real keen interest in learning how to build a straw bale house, you can visit two new straw bale houses, one in Inverleigh in the morning and one down in Wensleydale in the afternoon, and talk to the builders on site. Yeah.
That's so great. So do you think that it's probably the best for people to sit down, have a look on the website first and plan out the day?
If they go to the website and they register, which over 300 already have, to attend, then we'll send you the actual specific addresses, and they can then work out where... Yeah, they really need to work out a little driving map. But on the website, there's a Google map, so you can actually see quite specifically where they are and plan a route.
Yeah, great. What about if you forget to do that? and it's on the day, can you still get the addresses?
You can still get the addresses. The addresses are being publicised in the Times News Group, which is Surf Coast Times, Armstrong Creek, Ballerine Times. So the full addresses are published there. We've also made a little A6 colour postcard, which has got the addresses on, and that can be picked up at council, customer service centres, libraries, neighbourhood houses, and we're getting them spread far and wide.
Do people actually come to you, Vicky, at Geelong Sustainability, and say, I've got a house that, you know, I think is worthy of being in this day? Or do you actually approach people? How do people get involved?
Sometimes people will come direct. Sometimes I've met them through the network. Sometimes we do always reach out each year to some of the architects and builders that we've worked with in the past, and we're really delighted that we've got homes this year from Homes with Integrity, from SOR Constructions, and from AFI Projects, which are ones which have had homes in the past and very much have a reputation for building sustainable homes. Yeah.
Great. Well, yeah. We've got a studio full of, obviously, I would be assuming homeowners.
You have indeed.
Yeah. They're really keen to tell us more.
So let me introduce you to Frank and Sue, who are our poster house. So it's always a great treat to be the poster house. And our photographer, Phil Hines, when we were coming up to do a photo shoot, we turned the corner and went, here's the poster photo. Their beautiful home in Port Arlington is our poster. They are owner builders, so I'm going to pass over to Sue to tell you a little bit more about their home, which is built in
2013. We had a large family home in Newtown with three children who were slowly disappearing. Not forever.
Not literally.
Just leaving home.
Unfortunately, not enough.
And our home was built in 1927, very old, weatherboard house, and we decided once the last child had moved to live somewhere else that we'd renovate. We got a quote for that, and it was about $60,000, which we just didn't have. It was a house that was a lovely home, but leaked air, none of the doors and windows shut properly. We'd never contemplated building, but one day we went for a drive down around the Ballerine, went to Queenscliff. We looked there. That was lovely, but not affordable for us. And then we happened across this block on a Sunday morning. We purchased it the next day. And in Port Arlington, we'd already spoken to a friend of ours who ended up being the man who designed our house, Stuart Miller, who works out of Queenscliff. Stewie told us that we would definitely fit a family home on that block, so from there we did a 3-month process of designing the home, and once that was done and dusted and we were vaguely happy, there were things we did along the way. We started building in June and moved in 9 months later, so it was a bit like having a baby, really.
Gestation periods.
Yes. Possibly our intention at the time was to make a home that required very little maintenance, and was easy to maintain. So I think the two things are vaguely different. And we wanted a home that we didn't have to pour large amounts of money into painting and replacing weatherboards as we'd done for years. And that costs money, and that's, I didn't want to be tipping paint down a drain hole or washing brushes in water. So that was one thing. We also wanted a home that was really easy to look after. And so our home is built out of
Colour bond on the top floor that's rolled that look like weatherboards.
Yes.
That's very neat. Yeah.
So there's no maintenance. We might hose it down. We've got a very... our garden was designed by a lovely woman who used to work at a local nursery, and all the plants in that are low... we talked about a watering system and she guaranteed us that we would never need one. So it's very low maintenance, low water usage. We've got some vegetable garden which we use. We're also quite specific about, and I think this is a point, that we have minimal storage space. We have a tiny wee little linen press. My friends all laugh at it. But other than that, we've got wardrobes in bedrooms, but very little storage space. The reason being, we can't buy stuff.
Yeah, so is that so you can stay minimal?
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
So we just can't afford...
I love that idea.
We just can't... we don't have the space to... If we buy something, if something comes in, something has to go out.
I love it. Yeah. I'm trying to tell my kids that after school holidays, my house actually looks like it's been robbed. and I think I've got way too many things. So I really love that idea. Yeah. Something to go out to come
in. It can
be
hard to do if all family members don't buy into it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I've got to get to your spot where they actually leave.
Yeah. 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 Or they often leave their school assignments.
Oh, we've still got bedrooms to clean out, don't worry. Our 31-year-old is still using our house as a storage facility. Oh, but... Yes. But even that is quite minimal. So I think that's one of the key points for me, that we used to have a big home, and when you have a big home, you tend to clutter. I've got paintings that I can't hang up because we just don't have walls, and I'm slowly gifting them or giving them away and, using them for raffle prizes for different organisations.
Great.
So, yeah, they're disappearing.
Good on you.
Mm. Living your principles, it sounds like.
Yeah. We're trying to.
Yes.
Yeah. So we did own a building, which was incredibly scary at the time, but we had really good support from Stuart Miller, and he put us onto a lot of tradies. But the huge advantage was we know where every nail, every screw, and every piece of insulation is in that home. We did the insulation. We made sure that every square inch was covered with really good rating insulation material. The design, we spent backwards and forwards using computer design to make sure that the house was really great for a passive solar. Like on a day like today, which is beautiful sunshine, it's going to be about 24 degrees. We've actually already got the front, the deck door open to let the heat out because it just gets too warm, and not in a bad way. On a winter's day or a spring day, we have walk around in t-shirt and shorts. Most mornings, we get up in the morning and it's probably the lowest temperature you would find in the middle of winter would be 14 or 15 degrees, where in our old house in Newtown it was about 9 or 8 or 7 freezing. So we've got solar, power, haven't gone down the battery route yet, but which we will. We've got UPV double glazed window, so so steel window frames with like a plastic on the outside of them that's means we don't
standard.
Have to paint them.
Yeah,
yeah, really European standard, designed by Europeans, made by some Russian men and women in Melbourne and then installed in Geelong. So they're tight. Even our front door has 5 locking points to stop when we shut the door. You can sort of move a lever and it stops any air in there. We actually have to have windows open to let air in and out. The northerly aspect was one of the other things that sold us on the block. And if you do come down and have a look at the home, the views aren't too bad at all.
You look over to the Yu Yangs, it's rather gorgeous.
You see Geelong from one side, Melbourne from the other side, and the Yu Yangs in the middle.
Lovely. Can I just ask, and because you said that you were going to renovate your house originally for $60,000 and you didn't have that money, but then you bought a block and built a house. Am I assuming that that's for less than $60,000?
No.
We're getting
financial, but we sold our house in Newtown.
Okay,
And that, which we were very fortunate to own outright. So we sold that in Newtown, and that afforded us the ability. When we finished our house, we basically spent what we sold our house for, and we had. I was driving a car that was driving in and out to work, in a car that was incredibly inefficient. So we sold that car and bought a much smaller, much more efficient car. So that was the end. We'd run out of money.
Terrific.
Done and dusted.
But you just swapped one thing for the other. So
yeah, but without the maintenance, without painting weatherboards, without replacing weatherboards, without paying... Like, our electricity bill is just about half of what one... You know, you get on your electricity bill, the little bodies down the side, and it shows you how much you're using. We use about half of what one person does.
It's awesome, and I guess it's like, you know, you have to change something to make something great, which is good. So thanks so much for coming on and telling us.
Yeah. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Excellent, and we have a line of guests coming in, but I also just wanted to squeeze in a little report, because something else that we all can do is, you know, we can look after how we deal with our food, that we don't buy more than we eat and so on. And here's a little report from Denmark. Lene, our reporter, has been talking to some people who've done something where they're actually saving not just kilos, but thousands of tons of food that normally would have been thrown away, but now it's sort of come back into the system and actually being both sold and eaten.
Sustainable people, that's about you and me. What can we do to get this world back on track? WeFood is a Danish chain of shops selling surplus food. The founder is the NGO Danchurch 8, and their shops have now reduced the food waste from Danish supermarkets from 700,000 ton to now 500,000 ton a year. So hopefully we can reach zero food waste in Denmark within a few years. Besides fighting food waste, the NGO is raising money for those in need. I talked to Jan Petersen from WeFood in Copenhagen and with two customers.
I think it was 1st of January of 2015, there was a change. So now it would be legal for every shop to sell the goods when it reached and exceeded the best before date. So that was the first indicating, okay, now WeFood is actually a possible solution or a concept to try to be a part of the food waste problem. And then when you have project in the area where you see a lot of hunger, when you see people who are in daily need of food, it's hard to imagine when we throw out, you said the number, 700,000 tons of food here in Denmark alone. So what can we do? We can't transport the food from Denmark and say, okay, here, you can have the baked potatoes or the frozen spring rolls. We can't do that. The expense would be just too high. But here, we can actually give something back. We can generate some kind of revenue. And then we have a lot of great experience in the secondhand shop and with the volunteers. So we knew that it would be possible.
What is the vision?
We haven't actually, put out a specific number, but we want to be more. We want to open more shops. So in the next maybe three years, we're going to open maybe 4 to 6 new shops, and we want to be more, not just as Copenhagen, which is the capital, but come out more in the country. But it has to be in the bigger cities here in Denmark.
My name is Anna. I'm 19 years old and I just started my second gap year.
I met you here in the WeFood shop in Nørrebro. What are you doing here?
I'm looking for some groceries so I can make some lunch. I think food waste is a huge problem in our society, and I think this is a great way to both minimize food waste and also save a lot of money because it's a lot cheaper. I mean, I don't know if it's a new trend, but I definitely think it's something that's becoming more and more popular because people see all the benefits.
What we're doing here at WeFood is actually we're trying to give something back. We are part of a big NGO, the Dan Church Aid, and what's the revenue, all the money that we sell, we can give that back to the NGO. So we can give that back to projects in Malawi and where we have hunger, in the areas where we have flash floods, where the climate change just strikes bigger. So if you have a hot environment, it just get even hotter. So actually what we donated back to the NGO was €150,000. So that's just a way for us to say, okay, we want to both fight food waste, but we also have a higher purpose. And the higher purpose is we have to generate some money back to the NGO. There was a high demand on the first shop when it opened. The press was enormous and it was international because it was the first supermarket with surplus food. So it drew on a lot of attention towards the opening of the shop. And to be fair, we didn't have enough groceries in the first shop. After 2 or 3 days, the shop was empty. It's positive, but it also, it also gave us a problem because we lost a lot of confidence in those weeks and those months of the opening. And it nearly took us maybe a year just to get, a lot of new partnerships which donated food to us and where we could say, okay, now we want to open the second shop.
Sorry, could you explain what is a partnership?
Yeah, what we are trying to do, if you want to have the goods, we have to have some kind of partnership with the producers or the retailers who have the surplus food. So we actually try to make a partnership where we get the food from them. We go out and collect it with the volunteers, and then we can give something back. We can give a positive spin towards what we have done with the surplus food. What have you actually made in money? What have the revenue been? And how many tons have we sold?
Is the interest increasing? You see that?
Yeah, we see that. We can see that the customers coming to our shops increase monthly. We can also see it in the tons we sell each month. We can see that it's increased a lot. Like I told just before, actually, when this month ends, we're going to surpass the 173 tons which we sold last year. So we have 3 whole months to increase the total number.
Yeah, using all the stuff they are throwing away, and it's completely crazy to throw everything away. I just buy what I need, that's the solution.
When we come to food and retail shops, it's different from a secondhand shop. So it takes an insight and experience towards what are the laws to have a retail shop, and that is actually what my background is, and also my colleagues' background, which are in the normal retailers, if you can say that. So we know the laws within the background of our bodies. But yeah, you can, every NGOs could do it and open the shops.
If the Australians came and knocked on your door and said, we want to do that down under, would you stand there and help them?
Yeah, of course we would. It would be possible, yeah.
Hello, we're back again, and it's my pleasure this time to introduce Sally Wills, who is house number 4 in Norlane, which is an exemplar 7-star, very small house on a small block. Sally, tell us about Small Change Construction and Design.
Oh, thanks, Vicky. Small Change Design and Construction specialises in very small houses, and by very small houses I mean houses that are generally under about 60 square metres. There's a range of standard houses, and the one in Norlane, the house number 4, is known as Quark Extra Small, which is 57 square metres, and with a loft that you can use for storage or an overflow of guests if you have them. So basically it's a one bedroom with a full kitchen, bathroom and a living area. And everyone who sees it, can't believe it's 57 square metres because I've got 4.5 metre ceilings in the living and bedroom area, so it does actually feel quite large.
It is. Those high ceilings make a big difference. The volume, you don't feel crowded at all.
The way I look at it is that it's an apartment house, so there's lots of people that want to downsize but for whatever reason don't want to live in an apartment. So this is an apartment size dwelling, but you've got the advantage of your own piece of land and a garden, which is very important to
and
lots of people.
Nobody corporate. Any of those sorts of hassles.
Yeah.
And Sally opened her house last year and she also has opened on the Renew National Day, and her property and her philosophy have been written up in the Sanctuary magazine. So it really is leading edge, and it's something that you're trying to expand on, and you've got some other projects on the go in Geelong too, I think.
Yes, yeah. A couple in Corio that we're just almost through planning, which is good. So they'll be on lots that are 120 square metres and the houses will be 45 square metre footprint, so even smaller. We're just going to see how small we can go.
Oh, right. That is encouraging. Yeah.
Yeah, and look, I'm very impressed with all the other houses that are on the list for the Sustainable Open Day, and a lot of them have fantastic, they have solar, batteries and all of those sorts of things. But the way I've approached my business is that the biggest thing that we can do is actually start building smaller houses. Yeah. It's the most important thing. And you could, in fact, I believe, drop all of the fancy stuff and just do a bit smaller. Do you need the second bathroom? Do you need the second living room? Do you need two dining room tables? All of those things, if you can pull back that, that will make a huge difference to our greenhouse gas emissions. We actually, building is about 25% of our emissions, and that includes the embodied energy that goes into buildings, which is about 10 years worth of operational, 1 year of operational. So it's a huge, huge impact that we can make just by building smaller dwellings. And obviously not everyone is going to suit a one bedroom house. That's obviously a niche market. That's perhaps a young couple or perhaps a single older person. But if everybody gets the message that building smaller, so when they're looking at their family homes, they really question whether perhaps rooms can be used for two things rather than just one, and that all the spaces are actually double using.
Can I, when we go on holidays, so I have 5 kids, so a little tiny house is not for me. But when we go on holiday and we might have a cabin, and so it might be, two bedrooms and whatever, and we all kind of fit in, and
You have a great time, don't you?
It's so great, and it's so easy to keep tidy and clean, and, obviously you're on holiday, so you don't have all your stuff, but I say to my husband every time we go away, I say, I just want to live in a tiny house like this.
And look, I think that families could live in much smaller houses than they do, and they used to not that long ago.
If you look at the 50s
when Robin Boyd was designing all those beautiful houses, they did not have two living rooms. Kids shared bedrooms, and there was much more focus on the outside, and that's what a small house will actually allow you to do. You get out more.
Absolutely. Yeah, my dad grew up in a family of 10, so 10 kids, and they had their house. I could never get over it when I was a kid myself going to my nan and pops, because you would literally walk in the door. On the left hand side was the lounge room, then their bedroom was sort of around the corner, one little bathroom, and one other bedroom, and then there was another bedroom at the back, and then the kitchen and dining was all sort of together. And I used to think, how did they all live in this house? But I don't know. I think they did. And there was, sort of generate like different sort of age groups as well. And then the boys all lived in the garage and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, they just did.
Yeah.
And it was the happiest house to go to.
Sally, are there limiting factors around what you can build in some of the, we drive through all the new developments all around Geelong. So these great big homes that are built up close to each other and with minimal eave sizes and so forth. And can you tell us about what's stopping people building small houses on these developments?
Okay, well, the first thing is it is a misnomer, a misunderstood fact. There is no minimum house size in the BCA. That is definitely not the case. There are things that you have to comply with, but that does not tell you what a house size has to be. One of the things in the estates that you're talking about is that there are more than, usually there are design guidelines, and they're created by a developer. They're not created by any state government authority. And that the idea behind them is to set a tone and set a standard and set a look. So we can all blame the developers who are coming up with the design guidelines if we're not happy with the estates. And I have come across a couple when people have approached me to build in these estates that do have minimum house sizes. To me, that's actually, it's almost criminal that is required, because I've been approached by couples who only want a small house and they've got to build a 150 square metre house. Mm-hmm. And they don't want or need a 150 square metre house, but I can't help them because that's the rule. Mm. So there definitely needs to be some pressure on developers, and maybe it could be by way of, templates that encourage a diversity of housing and encourage, you know, small and medium size rather than just large. Perhaps there's also, you know, things in the planning schemes that can encourage that too. But basically it's the design guidelines.
Mm.
Thank you, Sally, for coming in. You certainly made me curious. I think I have to come to Norlane and learn about micro houses, micro villages, and doing things small. That's amazing.
Now, can we just explain, there is one more step when you want to go to Sally's house. Because it is a very small house, we're actually taking bookings every half hour. So 10 people every half hour. So when you go to the website, you can book to go and pick what time you'd like to go and visit Sally's house. Because obviously we don't want 50 people turning up at the one time, because there wouldn't be enough space and all of that. So that's what we just encourage you.
Ah, that's important information. Thank you for that. Yeah. I wanted to share with every one of you that here in this program we have talked for years about where are the artists. When it comes to these talks about, you know, sustainability and climate change and many other things, artists could really make a difference if they spoke out more and even started making songs about it and so on. And I just learned yesterday that Australia actually has an artist who has been writing songs for years and years and making one album after the other about climate change, making songs about climate change and so on. I wasn't aware of that, but I am now happy to, I think we'll play more of him in the weeks and months to come. Bruce Campbell sent us a song that he's just out with now. It's his second single, or maybe it's his first single from a new album that's called The Anthropocene. And this song is called Strike a Light.
Strike a light, feel the flame, let it shine, be the change. Rise above conformity, make a little history. Someone's got to stand up and stop this senseless ruin. Look and you can see there's trouble brewing. Take a breath, let it out. Was there ever any doubt? From the highest to the least, most of us just want peace. Nothing ever came to good by doing evil. Don't listen to the whisper of the devil. The devil.
You're listening to the Sustainable Hour today. It's the Sustainable House Hour with all these guests that we have in the studio. And we have Vicky Parrott, who is the president of Geelong Sustainability, introducing our guests. So over to you, Vicky.
Thanks, Mick. Now I'd like to introduce you to Gavin Pocock. And while we've been talking about sustainable houses, actually, Gavin is opening his very large garden at Batesford, where he's only been there a couple of years. Gavin is a landscape architect. He lectures at Deakin, helps raise his three young boys, and also has a garden consulting business. So is a very busy person. But we think this is going to be a very interesting garden for people to come along and see how he's laid this out to be a very productive, edible garden as well as natives. And he's an expert in swales. So tell people a bit more about swales, Gavin.
Swales are a way of managing water so that it keeps the water and goes into the ground as opposed to moving it really quickly across the surface of the across the surface. So it means that it goes permeates into the ground and gets access for tree roots and things like that, so lots more things grow quicker. In Australia, we've got, especially with climate change, we're getting a much more dry climate, so we need to get as much of that water to move through the continent as slowly as possible, and swales are a really great small way to do that.
What are they? Just for the uninformed, what's a swale?
Okay, so it's like rubble drains. rubble drains, an old way to say it. It's a low point in your garden. It's a low point in your garden that the water kind of pulls in for a little bit, and then it'll kind of move along. So you might have, instead of having your normal drain where the water goes straight out, you might have it goes to a pit next to it, and that could be classed as a swale or a rain garden. And it just means it's an area that the water kind of pulls a bit, and you plant it up with lots of native plants and grasses and things like that, and that means that they'll suck up lots of that water instead of going into the drainage system.
What's driving you? Is it because you get food out of it, or is it more than that? You know, because you're obviously deeply into also the design of it, almost as that this is the, you know, the challenge, but also the joy of it.
I love being outdoors. I used to work in an office. I don't do that anymore, which is fantastic. So we moved out. We're in Geelong West, and we moved out to Batesford nearly 2 years ago, 2 years and a month. And, yeah, so we set up our garden with lots of, we've got an orchard, we've got a large vegetable garden, and we've also got we've planted a lot of indigenous trees. We've got 6,000 metres, so we've kind of zoned the garden off into different spaces, which means that we can grow our own fruit and veggies, but also offer some habitat and things like that for the native species that are around.
For me, the highlight is a chicken coop. Gavin likes to use recycled, upcycled, free materials, so fantastic. He has made a shingled chicken coop out of old timber fence palings. It's the most gorgeous thing. It's a work of art. It's got a green roof, for heaven's sake. So these girls are going to be really happy in the hot weather. So, look, it's worth going his place just to see the chicken coop.
So the chicken Hilton.
It's definitely.
It's one of my friends described it more. It's like the Weasley's house from the Harry Potter movies. So it's that's
yeah.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my friend's fences fell down. And I said, right, I can build a chicken coop out of that. So, and then I thought, well, I'm a landscape architect. I might as well put a green roof on it as well, and that kind of gets some more habitat for bugs that the chickens can eat. So,
And his pruning of his fruit trees. He's got a very large orchard. How many fruit trees have you got in that orchard? 40 or something.
No, it's not many. It's about 16 to 20 in that bit, and then I've got another 8 for citrus.
All right. As far as that hourglass shape that is the classic, that he's doing a brilliant job of getting them.
We're trying.
You're trying.
There's a couple that look absolutely spectacular, like I really know what I'm doing, and then a couple that kind of just like they're broken twigs. So it's definitely, my garden is definitely a work in progress.
Yeah.
So.
That's the key to all this is just trial and error and learning as you go along.
Yeah, just watching, like I watch a lot
observing.
Of gardening in Australia.
Yeah.
And you just Google stuff.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, I've got a, I lecture in landscape architecture, but that's not gardening.
That's different.
That's design, so that covers urban design and a whole raft of different things.
Yeah.
But all the gardening stuff that I know of, I've just kind of picked up as I've gone. So,
yeah.
And just giving stuff a go myself.
Yeah. And as well as growing really healthy fruit and other food, you're drawing down carbon on your land with the water and the result from the fungi and all that develops from that.
Yeah, so we're growing. So we're doing some different kind of composts and things like that. So we've got bokashi going on. So we've grown, we tried making some microbes and stuff ourselves, and we're putting that onto the into our veggie garden. We're attempting to do no dig, so that it's so it keeps all those microbes and stuff in the soil and keeps all that kind of working. And we're just adding layers and layers of compost and manure and things like that on top of it. So,
How big's the property?
So we're 1.5 acres.
Okay.
So, yeah, we've got, I think it's about 12 metres by 8 metres worth of veggie garden. So, you know, about the size of a regular backyard, just, yep. That's just our veggie garden, and probably about twice that for the orchard. And then the rest is just a really, it's just a lot of space. So we're planting in lots and lots of native trees, lots of habitat, indigenous trees, to create that kind of habitat for insects and birds and things.
So. Are you seeing that? Are they moving in, the critters?
Yes. I've been putting in tube stock that I get from the local indigenous nursery, and some of them are up to my waist now. They kind of go in about 20 centimetres high, and some of them are my waist. Yeah, some of them have been totally attacked by caterpillars and things like that already there. So that's providing, like, I don't really like the caterpillars eating my trees, but that's providing food for magpies and other birds that have been nesting. We've noticed a couple of birds nesting in our trees this year. So
terrific.
There's about three really big established trees on our property.
That's a great sign when they're there, because they've got food, and that's something that it's restoring habitat rather than the trend is destroying it, which is part of the problem.
Getting as much of those kind of native indigenous planting kind of trees as you can in there, and that kind of creates those kind of corridors and linkages and things like
that. Exactly.
So,
do you have bees?
I don't have bees yet. The plan is to do bees.
Yeah.
I've built insect hotels for my son Bobby for his class. I went in and talked to the grade twos at St. Pat's the other week. So we've got lots of insect hotels kind of going on for other people.
So what's an insect hotel?
Insect hotel.
It's where you could put those five kids when you go on holidays, Jackie.
It's a lot of organic materials kind of scooped together in a... you can contain it in any kind of way, but it's just effectively kind of like habitat for bugs.
Great.
So pollinators and other things like that, native bees, all that kind of stuff can live in there, and they pollinate your garden a lot better. So we're working on those. We also get some bees going at some point.
Yeah, terrific.
So the weather is warming up. It looks like we'll have also beautiful weather, I'm hoping, on Sustainable House Day. That is on the 13th of October, so it's two Sundays away.
Mm-hmm.
Vicky, maybe just a last word, what people should do if they've listened to this and they're interested and they want to come and be part of this, which I really feel is like a community, about community members coming together and teaching each other, having conversations.
We describe it as learn from locals how to live well. So be part of the change. We've all got to be part of that change. So this is a wonderful community learning experience, and they'll be learning from the homeowners, getting first-hand independent information, as well as all the technical experts who all provide their time pro bono. So we've got over 50 experts that will be available across these 15 homes, over 100 volunteers involved. It's a massive event, and so don't miss it. Go to our website. Book in, have a look at what houses you want to go to. Also, go to our Facebook page, because we're putting up little videos of some of the homeowners, so you can get some insights there. And there's a little slideshow video, which you can see, get a little snapshot of all of them.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And if you can't find it, simply use Google. You just write Sustainable House Day Geelong.
Yep.
And it all comes up there. To me, it's like a festival.
It is.
Absolutely.
A community
Absolutely.
Festival.
Just and the sharing of knowledge.
From one citizen to the other.
Yeah.
That is fantastic. Thank you and congratulations with all the beautiful work that you have done, Vicky, to make this happen for the 11th time now here in Geelong. Beautiful.
Seventh for me, but 11th for Geelong Sustainability. So it is a big statement
Amazing.
That we're making. Yeah.
And Gavin?
It's just such a wonderful opportunity. I love being part of it. I also just want to say happy birthday to my son. He's turned 11 today.
Ah.
So, he's waiting quietly with his brothers out there. So happy birthday, Ben. Well done.
Happy birthday, Ben.
He set up a climate change group at his school, and he's doing lots of sustainability stuff there.
Wow.
Doing, and
you'll have to have him.
They wrote a lot of letters to different politicians and stuff all around the state, and they got a lot of responses. He's just turned 11 today.
We'll have to get him on sometime.
He would
so much
would
happening.
He? Serious.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you to the two of you for coming. I just wanted to tell our listeners about what's coming up, something that I believe will be very, very big, which is the Extinction Rebellion, the Spring Rebellion, as it's called here in Australia, but obviously up in the other part of the world, in Europe, it'll be the Autumn Rebellion, I guess. But the point is that from Monday, a lot of people, maybe thousands of people, are going to gather and sit down on the street and block the city, disrupt Melbourne. What it's really about, Tony, maybe you can explain. It's about people coming together and giving everybody this sense that we're saying enough. We're sick and tired of politics. We want action.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Mick. We've tried everything, all the usual methods, talking to politicians, filling out petitions, all of those things, writing to letters to the editor, and none of that's worked, and they've just agreed to a carbon bomb essentially in the Adani, with the Adani mine, and fracking in the Northern Territory is just crazy. The science is saying it's demanding that we stop doing that, and they're being ignored. So,
but don't you think that when people sit out in the street like that, everyone else just get annoyed?
Yeah,
you know, creates friction in society.
It can, but a lot of the people in that are held up, there's people that who will go from car to car or wherever it is, explaining to them what's going on. And there's provision for emergency vehicles if they need to get through. It's proven that it works in the, it's non-violent. It's proven that it's worked in the past. We've got people from all professions that are prepared to risk arrest, to just shine those spotlights on. Once you explain to everyone what's happening, they say, how can this?
So this has happened before, because in London in October last year, the entire city was closed down. That was the feeling anyway. And Jackie, I remember you being quite excited about the Facebook Live reporting, this woman who was walking around.
She was great.
Hugging everyone. There was a good atmosphere around it.
It was a good atmosphere, and it was very peaceful, and it was not like... There wasn't people screaming and yelling, and they were just singing and sitting and quietly going about their business, doing what they do. So, Tony,
are you going to be on the street on Monday?
Yeah. So
no
I'll
kidding.
Go.
There'll be actions all week in Melbourne with various, some targeting places that are considered climate criminals that are contributing. There'll be politicians that'll be targeted. There's lots and lots of different events. I can't give away too much.
No.
But police, for most of them, the police will be, there'll be police liaison people. There's regular meetings with the police and just assuring them that it'll be non-violent. And there's a group, a unit within the police that looks at protests and tries to make sure that they're safe for everyone. There'll be some places where they say you can't go, and people will defy that non-violently. And just to make that point, some people will be arrested. But it's just saying, like, we're normally law-abiding citizens, but we just cannot accept this. We can't accept this, and we don't have to.
I think the most powerful call that I have heard coming about this Extinction Rebellion, this uprise, this Spring Rebellion, as it's called. And by the way, that reminds me, you know, when you talk about spring, do you remember the Arab Spring?
Yes.
That was sometime 10 years ago or something, where that actually began with one woman who stood in front of a camera. She made just a YouTube, or maybe it was on Facebook, a six-minute video that totally went viral. And because of that one video, that one woman standing there in her living room in front of a door, dressed normally, and nothing fancy about her as such, but she spoke from the heart, and it captured everyone's attention. So a million people gathered at Tahrir Square in Cairo. And this was like the beginning of something that was certainly a revolution that started there, the Arab Spring. Yeah. And now we have the...
Well, it's on the back of that, Mick. We're standing on her shoulders. We really are. Like, she planted lots of seeds in lots of people's minds that we don't have to accept this.
So what I'm saying is that now we have someone from New York, and he's an actor, Michael C. Hall. Not so many people know that name, but if I say Dexter, he was the actor who played in this serial killer TV show, and he was really, really powerful as an actor. But now here he is, I think, even more powerful, and I think we should round off the Sustainable Hour today with playing this little clip where he's just filming himself and telling it as it is, why he thinks that we should all join the rebellion, the Spring Rebellion, this Monday.
And a challenge to our listeners, see if you think he's acting.
And if you can't be there on Monday on the street, maybe you can find the Sustainable Hours Facebook page, and then you will see some reporting live. Jackie has got her phone out, and she'll be telling you what's happening. And you can be there as a virtual participant. Join us in that way by simply listening and showing your sympathy with what we're doing from Monday. The Sustainable Hour is heading out to the streets.
Once the water starts to rise and heaven's out of sight, she'll want the devil on her team.
Personally, I don't want to leave this planet knowing that I did nothing to address the undeniable climate emergency and ecological crisis that engulfs us all, or threatens to. Anyone without their head in the sand feels a sense of despair over it, and a sense of disillusionment about government leadership and the media, about their persistent unwillingness to tell the truth and act accordingly. I support Extinction Rebellion because it invites me to move through my despair. Extinction Rebellion is the means through which I can turn my anger at the shameful status quo and my love for the planet into action. Perfection is not required. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be a perfect composting vegan who only rides around on a unicycle. You don't have to be an activist. You don't have to be an environmentalist. The only requirement is that you're a human being who cares about the life of this planet, who wants to fight for the lives that are presently threatened, and who wants to experience a sense of unity on the streets with your fellow human beings. We can all be rebels. October 7th marks the beginning of a global rebellion. Take to the streets. Your body is a powerful thing. Rebel for life.